Case for argument is Knutson versus Gonzalez. Mr. Falwell.
You know what? That's what it was. It's an antitrust lawyer. That's what it is. He's
an antitrust lawyer.
Right.
He's totally out of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Faywell, and I represent the respondent, John Knutson. The issue in this case is, was Mr. Knutson convicted of an aggravated felony, as that term is defined at 8 U.S.C. 1101A43M. I feel the determinative questions in this particular case are, should the court consider conduct underlying dismissed counts? And second, should the court consider conduct that constitutes relevant conduct?
Mr. Faywell, could Knutson have been charged in a single count for the two schemes of fraud against the bank?
Your Honor, I'm not real familiar with federal rules of pleading as to criminal case. I do some federal criminal, but not. I've only appeared in limited extents. I think the answer to that question, though, as pertains to Mr. Knutson, is it's irrelevant whether he was or could have been. Well, it's irrelevant whether he could have been. The question is what he was charged with, what he did, what he was convicted of. My position is that the court's inquiry should be confined to offense of conduct, offense of conviction conduct, and should not be also consider relevant conduct.
Well, do you agree that if counts one and two are part of a common scheme or plan, we could consider the total loss amounts for both counts if they were part of a common plea or scheme?
As I understand Your Honor's question, like the Tenth Circuit case, mm-hmm. In that case, I think that case is not the case before the court at this time. Yeah, in that case, I think that that's I can understand the reasoning of that decision. I have no problem with that. I just think it's not at all controlling in this case, because we do have the unique facts in this are we have two entirely separate schemes. It's as if Mr. Knutson was charged with possession of 2.5 grams of cannabis in July and was charged with possession of 2 kilos in September. Totally different cases. Perhaps they could be, for federal sentencing guideline purposes, for sentencing purposes, hooked up. But for purposes of whether he is removable, whether he is deportable, if he pleads only to possession of 2.5 grams of marijuana under the Immigration and Nationality Act, you cannot deport for someone who is convicted of a one-time marijuana case under 30 grams.
So
I'm sorry.
It's even more than that, though. The way I mean, isn't your argument that that there are two different severable crimes, and that one of them involved bank fraud that he committed as an employee, and the other involves bank fraud that he committed as a bank customer, and that the only thing tying the crimes together is the victim? Isn't that your argument?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I just mean to highlight that they are two entirely separate crimes. They're hooked together in counts one and two in the same indictment.
Let me ask you another question. Now, the statute we're dealing with here, the aggravated felony statute, lists all these, you know, little conviction of this, more than 10,000. But now, could the Immigration Service proceed against him on some other basis? Could it say, yes, you don't fall into one of these statutory aggravated felony categories, but you're a bad guy, you know, you've kited checks and so on, so we want to deport you anyway. Is that possible, or is the aggravated felony the only handle they'd have against him?
In this particular case, I believe the aggravated felony.
No, but I mean, suppose a person commits a crime, but he's not convicted. and then this wouldn't click in, right? But he admits he committed the crime. He stole $100,000 from a financial institution. He admits it, but he hasn't been convicted. Does that mean that there's no basis for deporting him?
That would mean that, unless that it would come within the section of the statute where you don't need a conviction, which states, which is the security and related grounds, any alien who has engaged in any activity, any criminal activity which endangers public safety or national security, he can be deported for that regardless of conviction.
It's just a national security. There's no other criminal. I mean, what if someone, you know, he says, I'm a serial killer. I've killed 100 people. I'm proud of it. But I haven't been convicted because I gave valuable information to the government. I work for them on the side when I'm between my killings. So that person, there's no legal handle to deport a person like that?
Well, not as the way... Unless he came within the statute, which I just read to Your Honor, which is part of...
Aren't there other statutes about, you know, don't people of bad conduct get deported even if they haven't been convicted? No?
No, they have to be convicted. They either have to be convicted of certain crimes as set forth in 8 U.S.C. 1227A2, or they would have to come within one of the specific grounds of removal. It's just like in a criminal case. We can't...
But you're familiar with all the grounds of removal, and you're saying that in wherever they appear, all grounds of removal, there is no ground on which an unconvicted but confessed criminal could be deported unless he was a threat to national security.
Well, I don't want to claim to know the entire INA code by heart, but I do believe.
I mean, as a practical matter. We are less likely to strain to find this a conviction if we don't think there would be a big loophole, right?
But why would the court strain? The court's job is to interpret the statute.
Yeah, but
it also makes sense.
It also makes sense of a statute, right? So you don't want to have a situation where, because of some absurd technical interpretation, a huge loophole is opened up, and people who engage in serious criminal activity. Are allowed to remain.
But, Judge, I think removal is much like a criminal case. If we think somebody's a bad guy, if we think he's getting by for whatever technicality, the court's job is not to ensure that...
Of course, we're not. It's not...
In this case, the...
We're reviewing an administrative agency. It's not...
True. And in this case, Judge, I would point out that this was an affirmance without opinion by a single, a one-sentence statement by a single BIA judge affirming Judge Fujimoto.
But the question is what scope the Immigration Authorities, Board of Immigration Appeals, has to interpret a statute, you know, interpret a word like conviction. And its discretion to interpret it may depend on the consequences, right, on whether... interpreting it as narrowly as you want creates a big loophole or not. That's why I was just curious what other removal grounds there might be that didn't have anything to do with, wasn't based on convictions. And you say just national security.
Well, you know, in preparing for this, that's one question I really didn't anticipate being asked. How can the prosecution, the government, get your guy... How should they have gotten about doing it? I mean, I'm hoping I win and I'm sent back down, and I really don't want to give a legal opinion as to how they should go about doing it. But the long and the short of it is, the focus should be on the plain language of the statute. It should be on what the statute states and not worried about collateral matters such as, are we doing the right thing? That's Congress's job. It's Congress's job to write the statute. If there's a technicality, if there's something wrong in the statute, it's the court's job to follow the statute as written. And I think the statute as written clearly states, the plain language of the statute states that to be deported for an aggravated felony, it is not enough for someone to have committed an aggravated felony. They must have been convicted of an aggravated felony. Now, and I did state in my brief, there are in that same 8 U.S.C. Section 1227 is the largest body of the removal grounds. If the court, if focusing on 1227 gives you, I believe, 90% of all what I've seen, with the exception of perhaps marriage fraud, 1227 gives all the grounds of removal, and it does, for criminal grounds, which is Section A2A, certain criminal grounds require a conviction, certain acts, or the commission of certain acts, can constitute grounds for removal. So when Congress knows how to distinguish between conviction and commission of an act, and I think they've clearly done that with aggravated felony, therefore I think dismiss counts and relevant conduct are not to be, while they're out there, and they're perfectly relevant.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Faywell. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Beyer, we'll give you a minute at the end. So, Phil.
May it please the Court, Brian Beyer on behalf of Respondent Alberto Gonzalez. To address a couple of the issues that the Court is concerned about, Judge Rovner asked, could all of this conduct have been charged as a single count? The answer to that question depends upon whether it would be viewed as a single execution of the offense. And that's a rather subtle and complicated question. If the Court would like to receive some supplemental briefing on the issue, I'd be happy to provide it.
Well, the fact of the matter is that it wasn't. And the plea agreement seems crystal clear on the amount of loss for the offense of conviction. $4,300 plus $50 plus $3,000, which equals $7,350. He admits the other conduct is relevant conduct, not conduct comprising the offense of conviction. And given the specificity of this plea, we would have to split from the Ninth Circuit to rule in your favor, wouldn't we?
No, Your Honor. And the difference here is that the Ninth Circuit was concerned about giving the alien the benefit of his plea bargain. The plea agreement included the specific language, "loss to the victims is." And the Ninth Circuit was not disagreeing with the Kalayla rationale.
But I think the problem you have is that there are two crimes here. I don't think it's one scheme to do. I don't think there's any indication it was one scheme to defraud. I mean, it could be. You could say, "Oh, this bank has no security procedures, so I can embezzle and I can also kite checks," you know, because this is a real patsy. There's no indication of that. It looks like two crimes. The second, a crime that kiting anyone could do. You don't have to be a bank officer. So if it's two crimes and he's convicted of one, why isn't that the end of the case? That's what the statute says.
Well,
that's why I was curious whether there are any other ways in which you can get it. Criminals who aren't convicted of an aggravated felony.
Well, Your Honor, I would be happy to submit a supplemental brief on that. It seems like the kind of case that would involve that is a crime involving moral turpitude. But I would need to make sure that all the other criteria in the statute are met.
Well, just as Judge Posner says, the plain language of the statute refers to a conviction for an aggravated felony. And, I mean, why would we be looking beyond the plain language to include relevant conduct? I don't get it.
Well, Your Honor, the court doesn't need to look beyond the conviction because the essential element of a 1344 offense includes a scheme.
Right, but you don't have a scheme here. That's
the problem. Have two schemes.
That's why you can't have it all in one count. Because you don't have a scheme. There's no evidence there's a scheme.
Your Honor,
one thing as a bank employee, one as a customer. And distance and time, no testimony that hooks it up in any way. Well, it was a plea anyway, but there's no facts in the plea that even suggests that it was a scheme.
Well, Your Honor, the court also has the judgment of conviction. And the judgment of conviction...
On the one count.
Yes. And the judgment of conviction adopts the factual findings and guideline application in the pre-sentence report.
Right.
And the pre-sentence report includes a paragraph reviewing what the offense consisted of. And that paragraph, that section, includes a paragraph expressly discussing the check-kiting scheme.
Right, because he agreed that relevant conduct could be considered.
Right.
That's all.
Well,
you know, it wasn't specified in the plea. Right. It's the sentence we're talking about.
The judgment is the sentence.
Yes.
And the sentence doesn't have to be identical to the plea because it includes the relevant conduct.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. But the pre-sentence report section that I'm referring to is captioned, you know, the offense.
Right.
Or the offense of conviction. And the offense of conviction includes the scheme.
Do you have some authority that says because the pre-sentence report says that we have to adopt that as the amount of loss? You know, that's what you're saying because of the way the pre-sentence report is organized and it's considered offense of the...
Well, Your Honor, I would just say that that's part of the record of conviction, and the court can consider the record of conviction in determining what the... offense of conviction is. And an essential element of the conviction is...
What did the pre-sentence report say? It said that the scheme embraced the two crimes?
Yes, there's a paragraph or a section that refers to the scheme. And
well, what does it say? Does it say he admitted that, you know, these two things were part of the same, he's going to get as much money as he could from this bank by hook or by crook, or what?
Well, Your Honor, on page 218 of the record, page 59 of the appendix to the opening brief, it says, count one of the indictment charges that beginning on or about January...
Where are you?
Record page 218, appendix page 59.
Appendix... A59?
Yes.
And this is the pre-sentence report?
Yes. It says, count one of the indictment charges that beginning on or about January 1995 and continuing through on or about July 1995, John Knutson executed a scheme to defraud First Star Bank of Illinois.
Right.
This is paraphrasing the indictment. This is not some additional finding by the probation office.
Well,
where does the probation office find that or explain why this was really a single scheme? Count one, I mean, this paragraph is just about... This, you know, the 7350.
Right, but then on count two...
Well, unfortunately, there's a big white blank in my copy.
That's how the original record is, and I'm not sure why that is. Later on, it says on the same page, count two charges that on or about September 1st, 1995, et cetera.
See, that's just a regurgitation of the indictment. Right.
That's correct,
you know?
So where is some independent information that would enable us to infer that really there was a single scheme, not two schemes?
Well, the nub of the disagreement between the government and Mr. Knutson is precisely what the offense consists of. It's not the indictment or the form of the indictment that's determinative here.
It's certainly not the pre-sentence report, which doesn't add anything to the indictment.
And my problem is you keep using the word offense. There are offenses.
Right.
These are offenses. You know, it seems to me that you're creating a disincentive to plead guilty or pay restitution in full with your argument because petitioners, you know, ought to be able to rely on the expected immigration consequences of their plea agreements. And
Where the plea agreement is sufficiently clear to reflect that understanding, then, you know, certainly under the Chang scenario, that would be appropriate. But here, if you want to refer to Chang as a safe harbor, you know, Mr. Knutson did not have the plea agreement drafted in such
precise. So then if it's unclear, then he pays the penalty. I mean, that's what you're saying. If it's clear and the amount has been agreed to in the plea agreement, then he's got the protection of Chang. But if it's not agreed to and it's vague and amorphous, then he pays the penalty.
Well, Your Honor,
and that's the rule you would like us to apply.
Well, let me disagree with you that it's a penalty. And Mr. Knudsen paid his debt to society in the criminal process.
It's a big penalty to have to go back
this country.
Well, but as a legal matter, the Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected the proposition that removal, even in cases of aliens who have been here a long time, constitutes a penalty.
But doesn't it make more sense to have a rule that says only the loss amount of the count that a defendant pleads guilty to is pertinent to the calculation of the total loss amount under INA?
That would be true if the statute of conviction supported that reading. But, I mean, just to go...
You know, and you cite Zhang, you know, for the proposition that the court looks to evidence extrinsic to the fact of conviction when it is otherwise impossible to determine the proper classification of the offense, and deviation does not require a hearing to resolve contested factual issues. And after you cited the case, you never explained how it is otherwise impossible to classify the offense here. So I don't really understand why you're citing to Zhang at all.
Well, Your Honor, the issue of whether there's a scheme here is really not a factual issue. It's a question, as I cited in the brief, to other cases like I think Longfellow is one. The question of scheme is what was the intent?
And yeah, but wait. Judge Williams, look, isn't Judge Williams' approach perfectly responsive to government's legitimate concerns? She says, look at the count that he pleaded guilty to. So, if you want to get him over 10,000, what you have to do is say the scheme embraced these two separate transactions, and then you have to prove it and so on. He can plead guilty if he wants to that or not. And then everyone knows where he stands. Whereas instead of, you know, kind of swimming through a lot of molasses of conjecture and inference and so on, everything would be clear.
Well, Your Honor, there's a few responses to that. The first one is that the plea agreement was entered into specifically with, and the terminology of the plea agreement indicates that it's entered into with respect to resolving the criminal situation only. It's not binding on the Immigration Service. The Immigration Service was not a party to the agreement or anything like that. And the agreement itself was drafted.
Well, maybe you'll have to work with the U.S. attorney to make sure they know that, you know, you want to get these people out, so you want them to be sensitive in their plea bargaining to the immigration implications, as obviously the defendant's lawyers are.
Okay. I'd like to, if I have an additional moment, I'd like to talk about the drug example that opposing counsel raised.
Because it wasn't a good example, so I don't, you know.
Well, it's useful for me because it shows where the analogy breaks down. The question is, you know, what are the essential elements of the offense of conviction? And the question before the court here is, you know, when construing 101A43M in the special context of 1344, where an essential element of the proof in order to establish a conviction is a scheme, the scope of the scheme
is different. We understand. What is the scheme? Right. Is the scheme just his embezzlement as a officer, or does it embrace the check kiting? That's the question. Well, and if you just read the stuff, it looks just the first. It's just count one. So, and then count two comes in as relevant conduct. That's the simple way to look at it. Why do handsprings to avoid that just very, you know, one scheme or two schemes?
Well, because, Your Honor, the scheme, the issue of the scheme is really different from the method of execution.
Well, let me ask you this. Maybe we can get at it this way. In the indictment, does the word scheme appear?
It does.
But within the count, within count one,
yes,
the word scheme appears, right?
Yes.
Okay, and within count two, the word scheme appears.
Yes.
But there's no preliminary language in the indictment that joins these two together to make one scheme, is there?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but the
and therein lies the problem.
Right. Well, each count of the indictment is a separate execution of the scheme.
There is no scheme.
Right.
Believe me, there is no scheme.
Right.
There are schemes.
Right.
He is a scheming person.
If that's the court's holding, obviously.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Beyer. So, Mr. Faywell, do you have anything further? You jeopardize your position further? You wanna?
No.
Right. You're doing well.
Yeah,
you should sit down.
Okay, so thank you very much to both counsel and Mr. Beyer for standing up for your position. We appreciate that, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.